So thank you very much for coming today and for signing on in such a busy part of term for this presentation, where I'll be talking about my research on the Irish famine, but also how financial crises, both during the Irish famine and financial crises in 2022, caused by budgets which didn't consider fiscal and financial sustainability very well, how they prevented policies to redistribute entitlements from the rich to the poor, and what policymakers should learn from these experiences in the modern world. Ah, here we are. Excellent. So what is so similar about the year 2022 and the year 1847? 1847 is one of the worst years of the Irish famine. Well, the global economic context is actually surprisingly similar. In both of these eras, there was a shortage of commodities causing inflation. In the 1840s, the shortage of commodities was caused by the harvest failure, particularly of potatoes, because of the arrival of a new blight, flight of four infestans from America. And also there was some more localized food harvest failures in Europe, such as the wheat crop failed in northern France in 46-47. This pushed food prices up across Europe and made policymakers worry about food supplies and food security. Likewise, in 2022, there's been a large dose of inflation, partly caused by a shortage of commodities triggered by the Russia-Ukraine war and the falling amount of gas exports from Russia and food exports from Ukraine. And so policy has the same, is in quite a similar position. There is the supply side shock here going to commodities. And there's a question for governments about should they open their markets to the rest of the world, i.e. should they deal with inflation with globalization, or should they just close up the drawbridges like India has this year by banning food exports or at least grain exports? And then there's another question, which is more of a question I'll be examining in this particular presentation, of how can entitlements to food, that means the money or access to buy food, be redistributed from the wealthy to the more vulnerable sections of society. And in both 1847 and 2022, the budgets which attempted to do this went wrong and triggered financial panics, which resulted in a loss of fiscal capacity and a set of austerity policies, which in 1847 had catastrophic effects. So you all might be familiar with 2022, but I'm going to briefly go over it in case you've missed it, you're aware of it in the context of this presentation. So the Liz Truss's government came to power in early September, and on the 23rd of September, they announced a mini budget, which was a mixture of unfunded tax cuts and a spending borrowing spree to subsidize the cost of domestic energy bills. The markets didn't like this. There was a surge in government bond yields. There was the biggest single day drop in the price of government debt ever seen before since 1694, the foundation of the modern British national debt. And it triggered a financial crisis, which could have taken down the world's banking system if the Bank of England hadn't stopped it in time. So this is the pension funds were forced to dump government bonds. And I think the losses, even though that they eventually were bailed out, pension funds dumped £500 billion of assets in about a week and lost £75 billion in the value of their assets during the crisis, which is a lot. And unfortunately, USS lost quite a bit of money in that as well. And the government was reversed the policies. They have made the energy cap only last 6 months, not longer. The cap is going to be higher than it was planned to be. And several policy experts have pointed out that this is likely to raise excess mortality this winter and next winter, because people won't, people on the breadline won't be able to afford, and the poverty line won't be able to afford so much heat. And being cold in winter is one of the primary causes of winter excess mortality. So what's this got to do with the 1840s? Well, I signed off on the proofs of a book early this summer, which was published in October, called The Great Famine in Ireland and Britain's Financial Crisis. And in this book, I explain why did the government suddenly change its mind change from a very generous position on funding the relief efforts in Ireland during the Great Famine in the late 1840s to a position where they were hardly spending any money at all in 1848 and 1849. And in recent decades, laissez-faire ideology, a new government and inspired by laissez-faire ideology, has been blamed for this. Although this book argues that instead they planned to go on a spending and borrowing spree, but that to pay for it, so rather than cut it, they were actually going to expand it, but there was a budget in February 1847, which involved unfunded tax cuts and a borrowing spree to pay for the relief effort, which triggered a financial meltdown. In this presentation, I'll quickly introduce how that occurred, how that's so similar to the crisis in 2022, and then the lessons policymakers should take away from that in 2022. So I think the important thing I should preface this conversation on, was that neither of these is a traditional government debt crisis. There were people throughout 2022 and throughout the first crisis, albeit not the second crisis of 1847, willing to lend the government the money that they needed. The issue is that the financial systems of 1847 and 2022 could not cope with that level of government borrowing. So the government would be able to finance itself in both of those crises. The thing is that it would push up interest rates to such a great extent that the financial system would implode. So at the start of this year, for example, in 2022, it was possible to borrow money for a mortgage at less than 2%. That figure is now 6%. And Britain has never seen interest rates triple in 9 months ever before in history. And a lot of that increase in interest rates, yes, it was happening everywhere, but this budget was deliberately designed in September 2022 to exacerbate that interest rate shock, to push interest rates up even more. The problem is the financial system, and it turned out the weak points were the pension funds, broke because they couldn't cope with interest rates going up so high. So the limit on government borrowing in both these situations was less was somebody willing to lend them the money. It was more whether the financial system could cope without crashing, without having a crisis, with the level of government borrowing there was. So I'll quickly go over what happened during the Irish famine, seeing that that's in my new book. So in recent decades, the change in policy from a very generous policy from spending a lot of money to spending virtually nothing was blamed on a change of government between Sir Robert Peel's Conservative government and the new Whig government led by Lord John Russell. So this is Peel on the left. He's the last prime minister in British history who never had a photograph taken of him. And Lord John Russell, who was the leader of the Whig party, came to power in 1846, the year after the start of the famine. Peel had set up a set of generous policies. He thought the answer to dealing with scarcity and inflation was globalization, keep the ports open, agree a peace deal with a war which was threatening in America to ensure that food supplies from America didn't stop being imported into Britain and Ireland. He repealed the Corn Laws, which were import duties on cereals going into Britain, and to make sure that there was enough, that would all ensure that there was enough food available to be sold in Ireland, but to give the entitlements to the Irish poor to buy the food, this would be done by public works. So public work projects, which were designed to put the money into the pockets of the labouring poor. And this is the set of policies that Lord John Russell's government inherited when it took over the British government in 1846. Now, in the received wisdom in the last few decades, the idea is that this new government came in with laissez-faire ideas, thinking the best thing to do was the government should stop doing anything and just leave it to the market to deal with itself. However, this is not entirely true. The new government actually came in wanting to continue Peel's policies and if not expand them. So Lord John Russell announced in Parliament a month after he took over the government that he wanted the whole credit of the Treasury and means of the country are to be used to avert famine and maintain the people of Ireland. In short, this was a bit like Mario Draghi saying, the government will do whatever it takes. This is very different from saying the famine's over, we're going to shut everything down and leave it to the market to deal with. So how did this government coming in 1847 with high hopes of what it could do to redistribute entitlements end up in such a disaster at the end of the 1840s with virtually nothing being spent in Ireland on relief, even as the excess mortality rate soared? And you could see that 1846 is not the important change date from this chart. So the first year of the famine, so that's the first bar of this bar chart, the Peel government only spent just over £1 million. So the literature currently says that was the generous period. And then the first year of the famine under the Lord John Russell's government, the government spent four times as much money. In 1847 to 1848, the government announced that it was going to spend between 10 and 14 million pounds. In reality, it only spended up three, and in 48 onwards, they hardly spent anything at all. So the question is, what went wrong? And the answer of my book is that there was the government, when it announced its new policy, that was going to make an even more generous policy, which was going to spend and borrow even more money than Peel. When that was announced, it triggered a financial panic, just like the one we've seen this autumn. And that forced the government into a U-turn and into a set of austerity policies which made excess mortality policies soar in Ireland. Therefore, to think about food security and you need to think about the financial sustainability of these policies, not just simply in terms of fiscal policy, but also can the financial system take borrowing and spending to that extent. So unfortunately my title has disappeared off this slide, but the title of this slide is meant to be the Bank Charter Act of 1844. So the question you might ask is, why was the British financial system so vulnerable in 1847 to panicking when there was an announcement the government was going to borrow a large sum of money? Well, that was because of a piece of legislation introduced by Peel called the Bank Charter Act of 1844. This piece of legislation basically forced the Bank of England, over a certain issuance of notes, forced the Bank of England to hold in reserve a certain amount of gold reserves to cover the increased issue of notes. So Britain was on the gold standard. You could literally take your £5 note and exchange it for £5 gold coins at the Bank of England. But this legislation meant that the bank had to keep a one-to-one ratio over a certain level. This meant that when there was a trade deficit and when the harvest fails in Britain and Ireland during the Irish famine, the potato harvest fails, that increases the deficit in Britain. So that will mean that people who exchange their pound notes for gold anyway to buy food imports from abroad. But at the same time, if the government comes and says it's going to borrow a large amount of money in notes, and it's that money is going to be spent on giving people entitlements to buy food, most of which is going to be imported. Essentially, this is announcing that the government's going to borrow a large amount of notes and eventually going to change it into gold, which is going to trigger a confidence crisis in the currency. Furthermore, because the amount you're allowed, the Bank of England's allowed to issue, is connected to the gold supply, the gold being exported abroad to buy the food is going to mean that the Bank of England is going to have to withdraw the amount of notes in circulation. And if there's less money in circulation, interest rates are going to go up. And if the Bank of England is there busy taking notes out of the system, whereas the government is coming into the market saying we're going to buy lots, you know, borrow lots of notes, this is going to cause a shortage of credit and cause interest rates to sharply increase. And when interest rates sharply increase, the value of assets falls. So if anyone's invested in Bitcoin or Tesla or a growth stock like Facebook and Alphabet or Apple, since interest rates have soared, the value of those assets have gone down. That also applied in the 1840s. And then the banks who have lent on the value of those assets find that people can't pay back their loans and those banks start to go bust. And this is why the financial system is so vulnerable to interest rates going up. So again, this budget was basically pushing interest rates up. And the financial system magnified that thanks to the Bank Charter Act of 1844. And the nature of the budget also pushed up interest rates at this time. So this whole situation is illustrated by a cartoon in Punch magazine, which I use on the front cover of the book. And this is Robert Peel using the dressed as Robert the Devil in Robert El Diablo, paralyzing John Bull using a copy of the Bank Charter Act. So that's the leaf holding over John Bull to stun him into thinking he's bankrupt. So that's why he's got his pockets out to him, because he thinks he's bankrupt. And John Bull is used by cartoonists in this period as to symbolize the British taxpayer. Meanwhile, Peel is standing in front of the Bank of England's reserves. So that's what the 9 million in boxes and money bags behind Peel is representing. And this is representing how the Bank Charter Act made the financial system more vulnerable to panics and to stunning it into thinking that Britain was bankrupt. And the result of making that Britain think it was bankrupt was that less money could be spent on the Irish famine for relief. And therefore, with that background of the Bank Charter Act creating a financial system which was prone to panic whenever there was a drain of bullion from the system and whenever the government tried to borrow a large amount of money, this is why the budget of 1847, and in particular, the announcement the government was going to run a deficit of 13 or 14 million pounds, the announcement of the first loan to cover that deficit triggered the crisis. So as we can see from this chart has two things. It's got a measure of the bullion left in the Bank of England and also a measure of the note reserves to total deposits ratio, which is a measure of whether a bank is the financial stability of a bank, basically. If it falls a lot, it means the bank is about to go bust. And these are the figures for the Bank of England. And as you can see, there is a panic which drains gold from the Bank of England and also causes a surge of demand for the Bank of England to issue banknotes to help rescue banks which can't cope with the high interest rates. And this is why both of these lines fall dramatically until the government U-turns and announces that instead of giving the money out as both grants and loans, and also the money being paid out quickly, the money is going to be paid out slowly. There will be no more further loans. And also that and also that the money will have to be entirely paid back by local taxpayers in Ireland, rather than most of it being, half of it being a grant and most of the rest being written off, in the same way as the modern student loan system. So actually the way they were going to finance this was invented for the Irish famine, and then it became the structural reason for the modern student loan system, where the government, the student loans are counted as part of the national debt, but not as counted part of the deficit. So the point is, the government was forced to U-turn and instead pushed the funding of this onto local taxpayers in Ireland, and also meant that instead of spending 13 or 14 million pounds in 47 to 48, they actually only spent 3 million. Now, the question is, so why can't they do something else? They could have amended the Bank Charter Act to make panics less likely. They could have raised income tax to pay for this. The problem is, this government was a minority government. It was rather like the Theresa May situation in 2017. The government was short, so the grey bar, the government was short of a majority. And they called it election 1847 and didn't win it. They were the largest party, but they were short of majority. They therefore had to either use Peel's remaining supporters or the Irish nationalists in Parliament to get their legislation passed. The problem is that Peel refused to allow the Bank Charter Act to be amended, because Peel, rather like Tony Blair in Iraq, you know, saw the Bank Charter Act as part of his legacy he didn't want disturbed. Meanwhile, the Irish nationalists didn't want the Irish income tax exemption to be abolished, because Ireland was exempt from the income tax in this period. And British MPs were only willing to raise British income tax if Ireland had its exemption partially abolished. So the idea was that both Britain and Ireland should have the same pennies in the pound increase in income tax. So Ireland would still pay less, but Britain would pay more, but the increase together would be, and that was electoral suicide for the Irish nationalist MPs, because the electorate in Ireland were wealthy at the time, just like in Britain, and the wealthy were the same people as the people who paid the income tax, and therefore they didn't want to see the income tax raised. So this minority government meant that the situation meant the government couldn't find any supports for getting them out of this mess. And therefore the Prime Minister went from saying that he was willing to spend the entire credit of the Treasury to prevent famine to saying, now we're out borrowing, that's the Treasury, British Treasury, borrowing from markets and lending to Ireland, we could have no great plan for Ireland. As much as I wish that, I've got to see that it is impractical. This is 1849. The question is, so what went wrong with the alternative policies? Why did putting this money on the local taxpayers in Ireland not work? And the answer is because the tax base was far too small. And the data coming back from the amount of money raised from local taxpayers and the percentage rates charged basically produces a perfect Laffer curve. So the Laffer curve is that you could raise, if you raise tax rates up to about 50%, you basically raise 100% of the revenue you could raise from doing that. But after you get past 50% tax rate on something, the amount you raise starts to fall. This is because people might take their money abroad, they might start hiding it under bed, they might lie to the tax authorities, they might decide to have more leisure time, there's no point in working extra hours if you're going to be charged 90% income tax on it. So you might start working less. And you can see this happen in Ireland after the burden of paying for relief effort was placed on local taxpayers after 1847. So in one part of Ireland, Ballinasloe, the tax rate went up to 170%. So that's 34 shillings, 3.25p in the pound on income from rental property. And the result was that if in a somewhere which had free movement of people and free movement of capital, you see capital flight and emigration. And this made the tax base even smaller, so the tax rates went up even more, which damaged the economy even more, caused more capital and tax flight, and made the whole situation worse. And as you can see from this, emigration to America follows with a 1-year lag from rises in In tax rates. Now, why America? Well, because firstly, this is an indicator of middle class and upper class immigration to America, because you need a lot of money to get to America because it's far away. If you have no money, you went to Great Britain, because it was possible to get a ship to Britain for virtually nothing if you're willing to be a human version of ballast on a freighter. But in America, it costs money to get there. It's also, you couldn't be chased for unpaid tax bills if you went to America. So this is why, in particular, this huge increase in taxes causes the middling and upper classes to flee to America. And it's part of the reason why Irish America hates Britain so much, because in some ways they were forced to leave their country through excessive taxation by the British state. Furthermore, another failure of the policy was that insufficient money to pay for the famine relief effort in Ireland meant that this famine relief effort relied on a single source of food for relief, Indian corn or flint corn, which is a form of maize. So Peel decided that this would be the main relief food at the start of the famine, because he read a scientific paper published two decades earlier about peasants living in Tyrol saying that it was possible to Indian corn without eating anything else. It was a perfect substitute for potato, because it's perfectly possible to eat potatoes and a little bit of milk and be perfectly healthy. This is not true for maize. So this is the first famine where maize was used for first relief food, and it caused widespread crashy corn pellagra. And actually, that was the main killer in the famine. It wasn't actually food calorie deficient starvation. This was contagious diseases and also nutritional diseases, and probably the nutritional diseases made the other diseases worse. And that was a policy make which is probably has carried on until recent decades. It's only in recent decades where the World Food Programme has gone, we need to think of nutrition more holistically and provide famine relief food which is better or more nutritious. And therefore my overall conclusion is that essentially what went wrong here and why excess mortality increased was the British government's policies to try to deal with this. How do you move entitlements from the rich to the poor went wrong. So borrowing the money from financial markets with a financial system which couldn't cope with that borrowing was the critical reason why excess mortality surged after 1847. They ended up with austerity policies then. We've ended up with austerity policies because of the Autumn Statement. And therefore that the British and Irish experience during the famine is that countries need a financial system with sufficient flexibility and fiscal capacity to mitigate shocks on their poorest citizens at a time of crisis. In that context, the Bank Charter Act of 1844 was a mistake. In that context, a budget which was deliberately trying to push up interest rates in 2022 was a mistake. The Truss mini budget of September 2022 triggered good financial panic because the pressure it put on the financial system was unsustainable. And the government knew this because me and some other people had written to the government when the new government came in at the start of September, pointing out that previous experience suggested that they needed to reduce the pressure, upward pressure on interest rates, if they were going to adopt a policy which was going to mitigate the impact on the most vulnerable society and without causing a financial panic. Unfortunately, the government ignored that, and that's why we're in the mess we are. So I think the Irish famine might seem a long way away, but the focus on things such as laissez-faire and not on things such as fiscal and financial sustainability has meant that the mistakes of the past have repeated. And unfortunately, this winter and next winter, we will see the impact of ignoring the lessons of history play out across the United Kingdom once again. Sorry, I think I went over time there, but does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Charles. It was amazing. It's very fascinating. I had to read the book now. definitely I'm going to buy it. I can I just ask a couple of questions before we open up, actually? One, I wanted to pick up from the last slide. When you say we are in an era of scarcity, do you mean in terms of resources? Because I wonder, there is a huge amount of waste, and I wonder if, and there is a huge amount of also of food available. The matter is how it's distributed and how it's accessed. So that was my first point. Go ahead with that, actually.
No, I was going to say, in terms of food, but not in terms of energy. So yeah, we're heading towards blackouts in Western Europe if we don't cut consumption. And the point is that the gas exports is linked to food production in Europe, because fertilizer is mainly produced from natural gas. So a shortage of gas means that there's going to be less ammonia produced, and ammonia production's collapsed. That means less fertilizer, and that means that food yields are going to fall. So can you see there's this very strong relationship with energy and food?
I thought you were talking about more food, but even in terms of energy, I do see that. However, would you agree that even there, if there were better management of the resources, there would be slightly less panic in the fear that there is scarcity? You know, say the fertilizer, yes, there is now a scarcity. However, there's also a huge waste of the fertilizer that we use, right? Likewise, water. There is the massive problems in terms of how we use the water, how we store it, etc. I mean, can this hopefully lead to better management systems of what we have, given that hopefully we open the eyes and realize that things are not going to last forever?
That's a very interesting point, but this is still a question of taking from the rich and giving to the poor. Because the people who are wasting these resources are the rich. And so therefore the ultimate question for the government is still how to take those entitlements from the rich. And because the rich are wasting lots of those entitlements, you know, buying, you know, Range Rovers rather than cars with efficient engines, or apologies to anyone who owns a Range Rover here. But you get what I mean, you know, as in, or people who don't plan their meals when they go shopping and therefore buy too much and throw a lot of it in the bin. Those are going to be disproportionately the wealthy. And so part of the answer to how to deal with that is how to take money from the rich and give to the poor. And it's also the speed of this, in that, yes, for cutting down on food waste and energy waste is important. But if the price of natural gas has also, that price of natural gas increased 10 times in about 6 months, the government doesn't have enough time to put new systems to respond. The easiest way is fiscal pressure, somehow making the rich reduce their energy consumption. And the rich do respond to price signals to reduce their energy and food consumption when the price signals are there. But doing that in a way where you can redistribute those entitlements to the poor to make sure that the impact of food prices and energy prices go up doesn't freeze or starve the most vulnerable in society. So hence it's a fiscal, I think there are more, microeconomic mechanisms, but in a crisis situation, the macroeconomic mechanism of tax and spend is the most effective one if we're dealing with a short, immediate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll actually leave my two other comments for later. I'd like to hear from others who make comments or ask questions, please. Anyone? Raise your hand or just unmute yourself.
What would be your advice for how they should have dealt with the what was happening? Did you offer any advice rather than warning against what they have done?
Yes, I did. So I suggested that they needed to, if they wanted to avoid a financial panic, they needed to make sure that their policies didn't raise interest rates. So the question is, how do you get control of the cost of living crisis without causing interest rates to go up? The answer was, how do we push the price level down? So the Bank of England raises interest rates and the market raises interest rates go up when inflation is high. And you want to do this without subsidizing energy directly, because you're subsidizing waste, basically. And in my paper, which I published before the mini budget, and I've copied the abstract here, the answer was to cut. It was cut the VAT significantly, because that pushes the price level down. It will stop the Bank of England having to raise interest rates. And you fund that by cutting tax relief on the rich. So you don't want to increase the tax rates that the rich pay, because then you end up in a Laffer curve situation. If it doesn't actually raise any money, it just causes people to go, I'm not going to do any more overtime anymore. Instead, you cut tax reliefs that wealthier taxpayers disproportionately enjoy. For example, pension relief, for example, if you're a basic rate taxpayer, you only get 20% back from the government. But if you're a additional rate taxpayer, you get 45p back. So why should rich people get their pensions disproportionately subsidised by the government compared to lower down? So there's lots of money which could be raised by cutting tax reliefs on the rich. Why is capital gains tax lower than income tax? It doesn't make sense, because a lot of capital gains tax and dividends tax is on is from passive investment. Whereas if we want the tax system to reward people who work hard, it should be income taxes lower, because that's on paid work. So it would be fiscally neutral. So push, basically deal with cost of living crisis by cutting VAT on everything. That would reduce the pressure on the Bank of England to raise interest rates, and you pay for it by attacking tax reliefs on the rich. So that's how the government could have dealt with this, but unfortunately it didn't, and the markets no longer trust Britain. Basically, we pay I think the Financial Times called this a moron premium now. So we have to pay more on our national debt than other countries, and this requires spending cuts and tax rises, which we've had in the autumn statement, to pay for this moron premium. And therefore, if we had done something like that, doesn't need to be exactly that, which was fiscally sustainable and dealt with the pressures on the government, the government would still have more flexibility to spend a bit more money, or not having to spend that money on interest rate paying interest on the national debt as we do now, or increased interest on the national debt. And we'd have money to spend on other things like welfare payments, more money for the NHS, etc. More money for pensioners, etc. Whatever the political priority is. But because the government introduced a budget that scared investors, means investors don't trust Britain, because Britain did something which was completely stupid. We will pay for the long-term consequences for many years to come.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed your talk. Found it really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, it does show that how things repeat in how things repeat in history.
Yes, exactly. We don't learn from the past at all. I wanted to ask a quick question. You know that there is a lot of focus now on at least attempting to make the UK more self-sufficient from a food security point of view and producing. So going towards almost like an auto key. What sort of financial economic consequences do you think this could have, which again, this has been done in the past in the sort of 20s or 30s. Is there a parallelism here that you can see and consequences that you warn?
Well, the interesting thing is, what does that do to foreign relations? So to do autarky, we would require Britain first policies. And I think the situation where the temptation of autarky is most severe at the moment is natural gas. So Britain has enough natural gas produced from the North Sea and from long-term contracts from Norway that we could basically shut up the drawbridge, switch the gas pipes off to the rest of Europe and Ireland and go, well, we're okay and we can charge low prices for this gas. Would the EU and Ireland sit down and take that line down? The answer is no. This, you know, pour petrol on the fire of the Northern Irish Protocol situation. It would cause British and European relations to cause a trade war between Britain and Europe. And it would make Western Europe's gas shortage worse in that Britain pays higher prices because it's sharing its supplies out with sharing its supplies by connecting its markets to that of Europe. And Europe has a much bigger gas deficit than Britain does. But a very similar thing could have happened during the Irish famine. If the government had gone banned food exports from either Britain and or Ireland, it could have produced a negative reaction from abroad of other countries introduced food export bans. But the thing is that Britain and Ireland had the biggest deficit in food back then and therefore had the most to lose from export bans, if Europe became a Europe of export bans. So autarky is an interesting policy, but the autarky collapses when you've got unanticipated shock like a potato blight causes the harvest to fail, and therefore the only option is to rely in the short term on other countries. But if you're going to rely on other countries in the short term, you've got to have good relationships to those other countries. So I think this is something which is worth discussing. How do we do autarky to increase food security by increasing food supplies in Britain without having a negative response from abroad? And that needs to be discussed more explicitly. How could Britain do some of these things without triggering a negative reaction from abroad?
Mm-hmm. Maybe Charles can be the topic of another coffee break seminar, I think. There's a huge amount of money at the moment from UKRI into finding and transforming UK food systems and making the UK more self-sufficient. So it would be really interesting to look at it from an economic and financial point of view, really. So I'm hoping that listeners will ask for opinions and you might be able to send yours, which hopefully might get heard this time, taken into account.
Well, I did get invited to the
Anyone
Treasury.
Anyone else has questions? Oh, that's good.
Sorry, were there any other questions? Somebody okay. Opened their camera and then closed their camera.
It was just following on from the previous question, and I guess you're just saying you got invited to the Treasury, but I was wondering what your sort of take on the more recent budget statements were and everything. Do you think they're just doing the only thing that's possible? Do you think it's still a bit stupid?
I think they did. I mean, in terms of dealing with mess, it wasn't entirely insane in that there was, that was actually a more progressive. It was taking money from the rich and giving it to less well-off groups. So reversing the effects of the previous. But it's still, government spending is going to be overall lower than it could have been before the mini budget. So it's more the bit that they were forced into doing things because the mini budget had been, had created this moron premium that is now charged to Britain for borrowing money. So it's more that budget is the result of the stupidity of the mini budget. And the point is that budget could have been involved, the mini budget could have been avoided had we took the lessons, took the right lessons from the past rather than believing in myths about the past. I did present a presentation about this issue to the Irish Prime Minister over the summer, and it's interesting how their budget was announced within a few days of the mini budget, was very fiscally sustainable in that they spent money on subsidies for the poor in Ireland, but did it in a fiscally neutral way and that provoked no negative budget reaction, and Ireland can borrow money at a much lower rate than Britain. Whereas I've now been invited to talk about this to the Treasury, but it was interesting how the Irish government avoided this, because they were taking the lessons from history more seriously than the British government. So compare those two budgets in the same week in Britain and Ireland. They've had very different effects. And that was because one was interested in history and the other wasn't.
That's very interesting. And probably they also read your paper.
Yes, the Irish Prime Minister is a historian. Ben again, Kwasi Kwarteng is a historian. Did a PhD in history at Cambridge, but he did his about the political thought of the Great Coinagery Crisis of the 1690s, rather than the economic thought. He's a history of political thought rather than. And he's got very little interest in actual economics or economic history, which is partly why he got into a mess. He thought if you announce something, the markets will believe it's true, because that's how political thought think of the world, rather than in thinking of economic concepts and in economic concepts and the learned experience from economic limitations on government in the past, which is how economic historians look at the world. So in some ways, Britain ended up with the wrong sort of historians at the top of the government rather than rather than the economic historians.
So we need to make sure that there are economic historians in the next government, really. But anyone else like to ask a final question or make a final comment before we wrap up? No? Tass, I wanted to ask you, but you kind of answered it actually in a way, but so the recent occasions when actually historians have been heard, but you just given the example of Ireland, so that's a great example. I'm pleased to hear. Charles, would you like to sort of send a sort of last message, or even in terms of sort of future research you think would be interesting to lead?
Oh yes, I was I was going to say my book on the famine is available for sale. It's like £18.85 on Amazon, or I'm selling copies for £15. So do get in touch with me if you would like to buy a discounted version. My next book comes out next term, which is looking at British financial crises in the last 200 years. And how to avoid them in the future. But don't buy that one, because it's priced only for libraries to buy, so it's £100 plus. But then my future research is going on to look at the impact of financial crises on famines around the world in the 19th century. So financial crises from London, because I want to use that as try to shift policymakers out of this view that having a high level of growth and not caring about financial crises is better than having a slightly lower level of growth without financial crises. Partly because that ignores, having a high level of growth with lots of financial crises ignores the impact on the poor of those financial crises. But also because if we're going to move into a world where there's going to be constraints to growth because of the environment, it's actually a pretty unsustainable thing to have high level of growth damaging the environment, and then you have financial implosions which hit the poor and vulnerable. So again, it will be another history project, but it has one which will have very much interesting lessons for the present day as well.
I'm sure that Charles, you have plenty of work given the circumstances. So I'm looking forward to more research. and hopefully it will inform the political actions. Thank you so much, Charles. It's been really, really interesting. Yeah, it's been recorded, so I'll make sure that people who couldn't attend will access it. And so thank you so much again. Thank you, everyone. And I will possibly see you next Friday. Is a question mark, because the speaker hasn't still confirmed if she can make it. So hopefully next Friday. Otherwise, it will probably be the end of our coffee break seminar for this term, and we'll start again next term. But have a good weekend in the meantime.
Thank you very much, everyone, for coming at such a busy point of term. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.